question before us this evening revolves around how is Call to Common Mission working among us? This is an opportunity for Episcopal Lutheran bishops and representatives to reflect upon that. We are, how many years into Call to Common Mission? 9 years? 8 years? Eight, if not nine. And it's an opportunity for us to hear from our bishops as well as our ecumenical officers. So I give you bishops and ecumenical officers.
Bishop Lloyd just leaned to me and said, start us off. I would think one of the most significant things that has happened indirectly related to Call to Common Mission is the deep sense of friendship that has been established between the lay and the clergy leaders representing our diocese, the Diocese of Washington, and Virginia Synod, the Metro D.C. Synod. Relationships have been established that really matter. I don't know how many times I've gone to the same meeting with Joe Vogt, with Larkin, Lark, Virginia Council of Churches, and as Phoebe Hoff taught all of us, this begins with relationships and developing trust. Thanks to the coordinating committee, the bishops in the Metro DC Synod and our diocese have been meeting for every bit of these 8 years, twice a year, with the coordinating committee. Significant relationships have been established between Metro DC and Diocese of Washington, the bishop chairman. The first thing they focused on was campus ministry. I'm sure Bishop Graham could say much more about that. But there is a heart to work together. And I think we're at a point now that we might plan to do something significant, but the relationships have been established. I would also say that the dream of this conference grew out of the friendships established by the coordinating committee. I mean, the energy for the conference came from the Charles Sidners and Joe Boats and many, many others.
I would say that coming into the position of being elected to serve as bishop, the first thing that really kind of knocks your socks off is when you go to the Virginia Council of Churches and you see the level of leadership that the Episcopal Church plays in the Virginia Council of Churches, the chaplain services of Virginia, the support for ecumenical work and social ministry work of three dioceses is really a pretty moving thing for me to see. And so that has helped to establish a real respect and appreciation. Bishop Lee really, kiddingly but also realistically say, he really is one of the icons of ecumenical work in the life of Virginia and has great respect from religious leaders all across the Commonwealth. So that through that time, it has become very easy that when I am looking for an interim in any part of the Commonwealth, I don't hesitate to ask the Episcopal Bishop if they know someone. And we have used some interims in that kind of way. We have begun Trinity Monita is an ecumenical parish, which is Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and Lutheran. And we can take no credit for that. Really, it was the people of Monita who really bubbled up this entity. And then the people in Galax asked for Lutherans to Episcopal parish down there, and so we are working on a federated congregation there. The reason I kind of pushed David to go first is that Chip Gunston, assistant to the bishop, with us, and David have begun good relationships for evangelism, for the planting, perhaps, of mission congregations, so that Chip's attending their mission, and you have folks attending our mission. And Fred over here, bless his heart, we're having good conversations too about possibilities of campus ministry or how we might start something together. So these are ways that, from our office, that we have a great joy in seeing what may be possibilities. I think from our perspective right now, thanks to our early forefathers that said the Germans go across the mountain, where we are now is in the east, you're very heavy, and in the west, not so. And in the west, we're kind of heavy, but in the east, not so. So there is a natural ability to reinforce one another for use for the future.
I might pose a question to prompt more reaction. There have been moments of recognized clergy and exchangeability among the diocese and synods. Is that correct? Can you say more about that?
I was going to say that one of the really exciting things about living in the Washington area is the appearance among us in the last 15 years of large Christian ethnic communities, especially Africans. Lots of them Episcopalians, Anglicans from Africa, lots of them Lutherans from Africa. And one of our most exciting African congregations is served by an Anglican priest from Liberia. They are Liberians. They wanted somebody from home, and just fit perfectly. And thinking about that, I was reminded of how I take that for granted. And I'm afraid that's a little piece of what I'm experiencing here. Some of the things, I have to be reminded that they are Lutheran, Episcopal, cutting-edge activities. Maybe not so cutting-edge anymore. The Lutheran campus ministry at Howard University is represented by an Episcopal priest, because the Lutherans and Episcopalians have a common ministry at Howard. I became bishop after a long experience in College Park, and then the campus ministries at the University of Maryland, the Lutheran and the Episcopal ministries go way, way back in partnership. And one suspects that they were celebrating Lutheran Eucharist together long before they had permission to do that. Because of the relationships. Because the campus pastors knew each other and trusted each other and liked each other. There are just a number of things that we do together. We have, with the Diocese of Washington, two relatively small but really interesting congregations in Southwest D.C., which is not a very big corner of the city, but which is very popular now, because that's where the new ballpark is going. So that whole area is being rehabbed, and they have an active conversation. Both of them have buildings that are too small and with too much deferred maintenance, and the Lutheran building in Southwest Washington is actually one of the architectural disasters of the 20th century. The roof began leaking before the building was dedicated. And that needs to be torn down to the ground or burned or something. But there is no reason why those congregations won't be able to find some way to have a common witness in that place. And they already go out together. We were talking about that the other night, about making common visits. And they already call on new families in their neighborhood together and say, we are the community that worships at such and such a place. We're Lutherans, we're Episcopalians. That's a wonderful, not huge, but large, a growing group of people in a part of the city that has real potential. And we just sort of take that for granted, Bishop Chain and I, because by God, they don't need too much help usually, and God bless them, you know? But it's those kinds of things about which we've already gotten interested and excited that give us great hope for the future. There are more things that we can do together. Maybe if we don't take what we have done as the pinnacle of our success.
Thank you.
we've had an Episcopal, we've had a Lutheran pastor serve at St. John's in Roanoke. We have an Episcopal priest who's serving at St. John's in Roanoke. I'm very grateful for the Abington Episcopal Church for helping us with some turmoil that was happening in a congregation down in the Southwest Virginia area. We have Episcopalians and Lutherans doing campus ministry together at Old Dominion University. Those are some ways that we have recognized.
And it should say something about the fact that when there was the disaster at Virginia Tech, too, there is the, what the word that got up to us in Washington was that young people were being cared for by the Lutherans and by the Episcopalians in that environment, and that that a number of people were able to trust that their kids would be cared for in that place by somebody. And it was a campus ministry down there too, where people had worked together, and that stress and that kind of pressure did some really wonderful things. At least that was the way it got.
Well, that's been a very strong ecumenical. It's had the Episcopal, the Presbyterian, and others. But they've really formed a Blacksburg ecumenical approach that has really sought to do good things.
I think we're seeing a shift, too, into the kind of new work that you allude to. Initially, I think we had a lot of exchange of clergy. That was something that was needed, obviously, in lots of places, supplying back and forth, interims, that kind of thing. And that's not to be sneezed at, because that's an important thing, especially in the Midwest, where I serve, for example. I mean, Lutherans were so helpful to a small Episcopal diocese in the Midwest, where the Lutheran ELCA is so large, three synods, one Iowa Episcopal diocese, and that continues to develop and to be amazing. So in those rural areas particularly, that kind of cross-fertilization, while it looks simple, it's been a lifesaver for a lot of places. Also, similarly, yoked congregations that were too small to have pastors on their own or priests on their own are now able to share that. But again, that can be critiqued as kind of a stopgap measure, this sort of survival mentality. And although if you are a bishop of a diocese like that, survival is pretty important. That's the first step. You've got to survive first, but you can't only be in that mode. And so beginning to see across the country this visioning about new church starts together, the kind of thing that would be really cutting edge and would put us out of the box as far as not believing that we have to start a ELCA parish on one corner of a developing area and a Episcopal church on the other. You have to build relationships first. You have to see how it works with these simpler kind of exchange of models and yoked parishes. And then when you see how effective some of those can be, I think the confidence is going to build to launch into some new areas, which for me is the exciting part of this.
David, could you or somebody speak a little bit more about how we're going on our Western Loudoun hopeful joint startup there?
There's not much that we can say at this point, Charles. Conversation is one of mutual desire to move forward.
Really a worldwide convergence of Anglicans and Lutherans around the world. You know that there's the Porvoo Agreement between Lutherans in Europe and the Church of England. It's a little bit different. It's a different kind of arrangement. There's not as much interchangeability. They don't live on top of each other geographically like we do here. Nonetheless, it was certainly a breakthrough, and it's very rich. There is a Waterloo Declaration in Canada, of course, where they have gone way beyond, I think, where we are. They're both smaller churches in a sense. They're more, in some ways, have not been as different historically. And so they've just kind of broken ground in a lot of ways. Bishops meet together regularly, not just on a very exceptional basis like we try to do. The two houses of bishops are smaller and more compact, and so they're able to do that. But the geography is immense. Australia has a similar agreement. There are agreements in Africa that are bubbling up. I attend each year something called the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Ecumenical Relations, which is my counterparts from the 38 Anglican provinces around the world. We meet annually and share what's going on locally so that we're doing some things we learn from each other, that we're making agreements that are in some sense compatible. Although each of these agreements is somewhat different because they are regional. They bubble up from the cultural reality of that province or area of the world. So they're not necessarily mutually interchangeable. But a good portion of that meeting is spent reporting in on what's happening between Anglicans and Lutherans all over. And there's different stages along the way. But it's very clear that God is up to something in this kind of worldwide convergence as well as what we're seeing locally here. And I think that is so important to name. There is now an international body. It was called for a while ALEC, Anglican Lutheran International Commission. I think it's been renamed in its new incarnation, but it's again a worldwide body to gather periodically and do some theology about these relationships, see what is happening and how to advance them. One of the issues that we talk about is the issue of transitivity, which most of us thought were a mathematical term, but it turns out to be an ecumenical term as well. The issue is, we have all these agreements, why can't we have exchange of Anglican and Lutheran clergy around the world? And the reason we can't is because these are regional agreements, and they have taken place, they've been effected by the canons and constitutions and governing documents of the local places. And there's some, full communion has been effected, but in different ways. And so only in ecumenical world, if A equals B equals C, it does not mean that A equals C, because there's simply not that work yet. But this ALEC, this group, this international group, is going to be wrestling with that very issue. Is there some way that we can indeed, at some point, deem these things to be interchangeable and transitive so that global convergence will be seen much more clearly than it is when they're very low.
And what's ALEC composed?
Sorry?
How is ALEC composed? I mean, how does the ALIC come to be?
Each province and area where there is such an agreement is asked to appoint a person, and we've just appointed William Peterson, professor at Bechelen, right, in Columbus, and who has been on, he was way back into the early days, of the LED 1, LED 2, LED 3 agreements, and all of the background work that we've almost forgotten took place over some 40 years, so he brings a good bit of expertise to this. So each person appoints one. It's not a very large body. 15.
In fact, one of the breakthroughs that has allowed the progress to have was an international bilateral in the Niagara Agreement.
Absolutely.
So that is, in a sense, is top down.
Yep.
But it, to be effective, has also, as you said, been bubbling up, bottom up.
Yeah.
So we've needed both directions to make the progress that we have.
Joe asked about the fact that we really ought to name that Niagara Declaration as part of this. It's in your packets as part of the CCM document that was included in the folders. Probably ought to say that together as a creed at some point, except it's not a creed, obviously, but it is a statement of a theological convergence that I find exciting and amazing, really, that we have that much convergence theologically about basically creedal matters, but also sacramental theology and other things that are really summarized in that Niagara statement. It's wonderful. Agreed.
Yeah, I think that's a
And in fact, I think that's what makes Call to Common Mission sing. A lot of people think Call to Common Mission is just about consistency and recognizability and exchangeability. Please read the doctrinal section called Niagara, and we'll all go, Yahvol, and you betcha. Because it's beautiful.
It really is.
It's what the two of you have brought to us today in terms of justification by grace through faith, and the marks of Anglican, the Anglican way.
The fact that we can both recognize ourselves so clearly within those statements is what makes this possible. And I know lots of people would point to an individual expression of CCM on a local level and say, we don't need Call to Common Mission to do that. We could have done some of that before. Well, you couldn't have done all the changeability of ordained ministers before, but you could have done certain kinds of outreach and mission. The point is, we didn't. You have to get to a certain point of theological convergence and a certain point of common worship and life together and relationship building before these things begin to break forth. Even though they may look one doesn't necessarily follow the other.
It seems to me that one of the strengths of the Lutheran Episcopal relationship and our whole history of lead, 1, 2, 3, is that in fact we said we're going to do the theology, and we did the theology that then allowed the success of CCM. And that, I hold that up as a model for other ecumenical activity. It seems to me that's why we have been so successful.
One of our colleagues at this conference mentioned to me earlier today, I'm surprised, but then this person is fairly well read ecumenically, I'm surprised at how much our colleagues don't know ecumenically, and how there is a lack of ecumenical knowledge about what our churches are up to and can do and agree upon. And I would wonder whether that's, do you confront that as bishops, and how do we move beyond that? I mean, I know conferences like this are one of the ways of getting at it, but we have churches where people choose to not read and not be informed.
So when you say colleagues, you mean clergy on the ground, congregations on the ground, how much they don't know about what we've got?
We've got a wonderful 80 here, but how many are not here? And persist in the illusion that Lutherans are only allowed at Lutheran altars or Anglicans at Anglican altars. I mean, there's a lot of ignorance, I think, that perdures and persists, unfortunately.
I would like to ask a question that as Bishop Hoyt implied earlier today, Eastern Lutherans are very much different from Midwestern Lutherans. And there's an Eastern Lutheran mistake. And I'm wondering how, from the top down, do you and perhaps Bishop Hutting envision using this gathering as a model that can be shared in other places across the church? What do you see as the next step from your perspective?
I think we both have acknowledged while we've been here, even in conversations with some who are gathered here, that this is very unique. What happens here, ask Chris if you knew of another place where there certainly has been clergy conferences for Lutherans and Episcopal clergy to be together. There's been invitations, but not with this type of setting, agenda, and sharing. I think this is a model, and we do intend on sharing what happened here at the workshop on Christian unity is saying this is an example of what can be done. I shared after this afternoon's session that I had a conversation with two people who are here. On one side, there were two Episcopal representatives who said, members who said that they were not aware that the Lutheran Book of Concord was just for Lutherans. Or that's what they thought, was just for Lutherans. They did not see that as being something that was really offered to the church. okay, and that was a learning. And overheard in the second conversation was a Lutheran said, I didn't know it either. Which I thought was kind of an interesting, just thinking that it was kind of addressed inwardly, and instead of saying that this was something of that was never to be shared, just kind of like the Lutherans. It was really, if you look at the history and the developments. And I think that does get to one of the major points that we have, is that there is not an understanding among Lutherans and Episcopal, or even some of our other Holy Communion partners, of what humanism is about. And Cardinal Casper, who's the little book on grassroots spiritual humanism, has a very wonderful way to say, this is teaching the Catholic Church, and most of us, not the Catholic Church, most of us will look and say we agree with many of the things, but we can enter into a dialogue. We need to have that type of exchange in our congregations. We need to have resources that can help with that very thing, so that the education, it's not just clergy, but it's also among our members for greater understanding. The difference between different parts of the country is, you know, some of the, for us, it's some of the ethnic differences. The Haugian movement, which is alive and well. When we talk about three orders of ministry, those who are strongly from Haugian would say, oh, we can answer that very easily. No order of ministry. It not only adds that the laity is the fourth area, but it says that's where the and so dealing with types of agreements and the comfort zone, there's a lot of education that needs to be done. Wisconsin Council of Churches is facilitating a ecumenical next February, where they're bringing ecumenical people in to say some of the agreements and some of the discussion. And I'm not sure if it's just Lutheran and Reformed or you know where it is, but it's underway and it's developed because they see that as something that there's so much isolation even among the people, there needs to be a greater understanding, ecumenical. That also could be a good example of how a statewide Council of Churches broadens the conversation ecumenical to look at agreements. But what we, one last thing I wanted to add, and that was Philadelphia Seminary has an endowed Episcopal chair. And that's been in recent years. The example of Trinity and Bexley Hall sharing together on campus. That's going to have an influence on formation and on relationships, to be sure, in on a seminary level. And I think that's a wonderful example. And how many of our students studying one another's seminary, I don't know the answer to that. But I think that there may be a growing number of people here in our seminaries.
I'd like to ask Bishop Lee and then Bishop McCoy a question somewhat the same, but see what their response is, honestly. I didn't mean that that way. Bishop Lee, how does the situation in the Episcopal Church in the United States, in your diocese, which we read about daily in our press, affect ecumenism? How do these persons on that side of the situation consider ecumenism? And then Bishop McCoy, how does the Upper Midwest situation affect ecumenism, and how do they view ecumenism?
I remember a meeting of the Episcopal House of Bishops back in the early 90s, I think it was in Milwaukee, and the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Milwaukee was the official spokesperson for the Conference of Catholic Bishops in greeting us, and he said that the routine things that one hears at ecumenical events where people are speaking to Episcopalians. We've heard some of the language today where the Archbishop said, well, we always thought of the Episcopal Church as a bridge church, that you were in a place between Catholic and Protestant traditions. We're now developing a new image of you, he said, and that is of the Green Berets, of a faith community going into new unknown territory that all of us are going to have to go into someday, but you're going there first. And I think in some ways the current difficulties within the Episcopal Church are mirrored, as far as I read the church press, are mirrored among Methodists, Presbyterians, and Lutherans. But we seem to be, the sexuality debates, the accusation that we're no longer Orthodox, that kind of thing, we seem to be on the front line of that now. And I think the way we handle it will have a major impact on our relationships with our ecumenical brothers and sisters. That the new dean of Virginia Seminary in Alexandria has developed the phrase that he expects the seminary to continue to be Orthodox and open. And that's a phrase that I'm attracted to, of that the Episcopal Church in its breadth will continue to be to include all sorts of conditions of people, and will be willing to consider new adaptations of old principles, but our allegiance to the Trinitarian faith of church, I think, is uncompromised and steady. In our most immediate issues here in the last 4 days, there's been a flurry of ecumenical conversations over the telephone and the internet, stimulated by the Virginia Interfaith Center for Public Policy, because our current litigation with churches that are trying to leave and take their buildings, the initial ruling by the judge last Thursday night, if it holds up and is followed through, could be a threat to any connectional or hierarchical church, and that our people are talking to one another about how we can come together in defending the integrity of churches that are more than, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is that our major constitutional claim is that the Commonwealth of Virginia, if the Commonwealth of Virginia tries to maintain that congregational polity is the preferred polity of congregations in the Commonwealth, that's an unacceptable interference by the state in the freedom of the church. We're very grateful for the support we've received by the ecumenical community on that. So it's conceivable, in direct answer to that question, that our current difficulties are going to lead to a much more substantial cooperative enterprise among the churches in Virginia.
Response to the question, I want to say something. The upper Midwest is different. It's not wrong. It's just, in terms of ecumenism, there's just a different way in which there's an understanding of ecumenism that is practiced in the upper Midwest, where Lutherans are denser. And they are. The example of where the exceptions come to the CCM agreement is Upper Midwest, and Luther Seminary would be the place where we would see most of them coming from. Because of the strength of the Lutheran Church, because of some, you know, when you're the largest church in town, or the
five largest churches in a small town.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. there is a, you know, how do you cooperate, or why, you know, the cooperation, they cooperate best in priestly and prophetic ministry, which is ecumenical. Caring for people, working together with people, speaking out and the issues of society. When you get to the doctrinal differences, why would a Lutheran want to change? And I think that's part of the question. In that, I chaired the Gettysburg Seminary Board, but also the Eastern Cluster, which was Philadelphia, Gettysburg, and Southern Seminary that up until last August. And we often talk about an Eastern understanding that was very real in all three, the way things developed. In Southern, Scott's heard that conversation when we talk about an Eastern type understanding of Lutheranism. Because of the Haugian movement, which for you who are Episcopal, Haugi was a person who was very anti-clerical, a piety movement within the church that really was very congregationalist, and scriptural. There were some good things to it, but what it has resulted in is, in that whole area, an understanding that often is anti-clerical, and has a way which was, in a sense, ecumenical in the same way. So that the exceptions, that 1.8%, probably is a reflection that if you looked at most of the Lutheran churches, if you would say you're anti-ecumenical, they would react in the Upper Midwest. Mm-hmm. It's just you hear the challenges that are not just ecumenical, but also about the direction of the Lutheran Church, where we're going, and why we're changing. Those are things that are very real. Luther Seminary is very missional in its emphasis, but it would not seem that it would be in the same way in an ecumenical formation. It would be more the four seminary approach, and that's the even have a relationship. That would be the direction that they would go in. So I think that the influences, they're different, they're not wrong, and that there certainly is space within our church to incorporate the differences. Although we had a person who came from the Upper Midwest to a southwestern Pennsylvania Synod Assembly, and it was a woman who was the head of one of our divisions, and she said after the first session, she said, "I came in to your assembly and my stomach absolutely turned when I looked and saw all this sea of black shirts, not only on men, but also on women." And she said, "I've never seen anything like that in my life." But by the end of the third day, I think she had adjusted to it. But she was very sincere. She had never been to a synod assembly where people wore black shirts. And it would be the exception that the pastor would not have a black shirt in southwestern Pennsylvania. Is that wrong? No, it's different. And so that's what I'm saying, you know, in terms of some of the blending. I went to a conference in Montana, and the bishop asked me to come. It was a clergy conference, and he said, "The only thing wrong, please don't wear your black shirt." So I didn't. You know, but I meant, that was, I don't have a black shirt on here either. There's just a difference.
But I just want to say that I think that as other things in this country, this is breaking down partly because people just migrate so much. In Washington, we have Haugians. You know, we have them too. We have all kinds of different things. We also have, again, a large number of people from Africa. Africa who have been Lutherans their whole lives, back generations, and who are much more conservative than the average Washington Lutherans. And that poses us all kinds of interesting challenges. What side is your average white liberal person to take in the debate between the gay and lesbian community that you want to support and affirm, and the African community that you want to support and affirm, when those communities are not on the same page at all? What's a person to do? It's interesting to watch people's faces when those debates start, because aside from the people who are very agitated on one side or the other, there's just a whole bunch of folks who are confused. And I think that's probably more and more part of our life in America, that some of the differences that are regional wind up in the same congregations and the same communities, and pose us interesting challenges.
Follow up to Mark's observation and comment and question to which you all responded. Michael Root, who was our presenter at Larkin, seasoned ecumenist and much beloved Lutheran, made the observation a year and a half.
It was 2 years ago now.
2 years ago now. That when we are at pains in our individual communions, what we tend to do as families and as denomination, as communities, is hunker down in the bunker, circle the wagons, and we don't shoot out at the world. We tend to shoot at each other and go internal and want to lock it down and have the conversation that way. What I'm hearing, and I think Mark's question provoked it, what I'm hearing us say is that some of these internal fights really provoke a kind of ecumenism where we're called to share the wounds in the body of Christ together and be ecumenical, not just in the sharing of joys and charisms, but to acknowledge the wounds and walk with each other in a way that I think really does call us to be Easter people. You know, we're risen, but the Christ also has the wounds of Easter, or the Good Friday wounds. And I think there's something kind of wonderfully pastoral about that.
Absolutely right. And let me say that we experience that. I think we feel that support from our community partners, particularly our full communion partners, but not only our full communion partners. I was in Rome 2 weeks ago. We met with Cardinal Casper, and he said very much that same kind of thing, that the pain of the Roman Catholic Church about the current difficulty of the Anglican Communion is because of that relationship that is long-standing, even though short of a full communion. I certainly experienced that. In fact, I was with our presiding bishop in Dar es Salaam when the primates met her first meeting with that group. And one of the things I was supposed to do was talk about the ecumenical perspective on all of this. And I said, frankly, my dear brothers, and we were all brothers except for Catherine, we've been treated better by our ecumenical partners than we have by some in this room. And that is absolutely right. The idea of I have no need of you, not what we've heard from our ecumenical partners, what we've heard from some in our own families, which is the most painful part of all this.
First, when all the clerical scandals in the Catholic Church here, ecumenical partners here were so supportive to Walter Sullivan and to the Bishop of Lourdes, really appreciated that. But then,
absolutely. In fact, we had a meeting at 815 Second Avenue that Frank Griswold chaired. Cardinal Keeler was there. It was to share, in the wake of all of that pain, what we were all doing around this issue, what policies we had put in place, and we were Methodist, Lutherans, Anglicans there, wide variety. And it was a half-day meeting, and notes were being taken. There were some heavy hitters there, and I all went back eventually into a report that was done in Dallas. I remember it was delivered in Dallas. So this is absolutely right. It's part of bearing one another's burdens and sharing the wounds of Christ in the body.
To push back just a little, or to come up in a different way, and I don't know my ecumenical readings, and I'll prove it here. Coming out of Tucson, words, my hope had been that what we were passionate about as Lutherans would be shared with Episcopalians, and what Episcopalians are passionate about, particularly out of the Book of Common Prayer and Worship, that would be shared, and that Lutheran pastors would hear the passion and the orthodoxy in that sharing, and Episcopalians would hear what it is that we're passionate about in our faith. theology about Luther that we would like to share for the church. And I'd like to hear the same thing about Calvin from our ecumenical partners in the Reformed movement. And in so doing, in my sharing why I'm passionate, then I'm really sharing what has been at the heart of the orthodoxy of faith. And as Episcopalians are sharing what is so passionate to them about the faith, then in that sharing, they prove ever so much more the orthodoxy of the faith. And in that, and so as we really intensely seek to share, we really find our orthodoxy with one another even more powerfully. But I think sometimes we've gathered together and we really haven't gotten into that in the passion of why we are so vibrant about what's special to us as a gift to the wider church.
You just confessed your ecumenical failing, but I will brag about you, my good bishop, because it is your passion that brought a conversation together with Chris Agnew and myself at a synod assembly where he said, wouldn't it be wonderful if we brought the Book of Common Prayer together with the Book of Common Prayer together with the people in the Book of Confession and had a conference. And that's why we're here.
The vision.
Yeah. And that was the vision which you articulated. And so,
and it's what David Bain did right after the agreement. He invited me to come down to the gathering of their pastors, and I will confess we've not returned the favor, but that would make great sense, is to ask one of our bishops or several clergy people to come to one of our gatherings and to share the passion of the faith that will allow us to hear that.
That's what I'd like to pick up on. And as I've been listening to this, what has been gelling with me in terms of phraseology with this is that if we look at it from the big picture, as we're supposed to sort of reflect up here as bishops, that I would hope that the ecumenical sharing, the full communions, forces us to come out of ourselves. And in doing that, it brings out the best of us in ourselves. Because when you have to come out of yourself and present to someone else, you're much more intentional about it. Well, this better be good. You know, I better know it. I better have it. I better be clear. I want to get in touch with what it is that I am passionate about. And I started my passion about this with LED3 and was so impressed with the writing. And at a time when I had been reading a lot of things that were not particularly impressive. And I thought this is something that I could really connect to. It seemed to bring out the best in both sides, precisely because both sides are different sides, you know, for want of a better way of putting it. Precisely because we were having to come out of our own selves.
And jargon.
Yeah, and the articulation that it sort of produced a new way of writing theologically that is the result of the two things coming together. And that's one of the things that I am particularly excited about, and what I want to commend for all of you as the frontline people with our folks is to read these other sources that we have in here, because we do write very differently. And I love reading what the incisiveness and the precision and the clarity that I find in a lot of the Lutheran sources that, frankly, I find missing in a lot of the contemporary Anglican sources that tend to be very inward-focused a lot, that don't have the same sort of clarity. So I'm very interested in how the reading that we do of each other's materials forces us to grow in how we are in connection with what makes us Episcopalian or Lutheran.
Ronnie, I'd like to say thank you for you came to us in the Diocese of Southern Virginia at a very painful time, and you got more than you could bargain for it at that clergy conference, and you did a masterful job of really being in a very difficult situation. We were having some real serious problems between our bishop and ourselves as clergy and lay people, and Bishop Bonner was kind of keen to address an ecumenical subject, but what he wound up being is an agent of Babylon in a very hot time in our diocese of life. Very painful time. I would appreciate that. You were a very good voice that we needed to hear.
I'm curious about as bishops, vision. Lutherans in North America, but every 25 years they get a new prayer book. So we just got one, and the next one, this is 2006 copyright, so 25 years from now we'll get another one. But as we produce resources, whether it's an evangelism resource or outreach, developing congregations, or it's a stewardship program, or a vacation church school program, or the next book, how do you all see your input into both church bodies so that we develop these jointly rather than independently? How do we live in our whole community here without it? What's your vision for that as bishops?
Let me say that certainly, you know, it's beginning to happen and needs to happen a lot more, but the offices of liturgy and worship certainly work together. We've been invited to this massive global mission conference that you all have put on for years. We've been overwhelmed by that. The Office of Ministry Development on both sides does a lot of work together. We've had a series of conversations about the diaconate, you know, the whole sense of the ordained diaconate in the Episcopal Church and the lay ministry of the diaconal minister in the ELCA is referenced in Colicon Mission, but only tangentially because there's such a hot button issue at that point. But how can the diaconal ministry itself be shared, quite apart from the obvious differences in the two expressions of it? And so that's so important, and it needs to happen more and more. I mean, I think we're beginning to see that happening as a natural thing. Clearly, this is a type of thing that ecumenical relations can do that will help us all in the broad sense of stewardship. Why should we produce separate resources when we have so much agreement around certain matters? There'll always be need for denominational specific programs, but clearly, in some of these major areas, we can be doing more of that. And I certainly encourage that all the time. We have this restructuring going on in 8:15. We do that every 25 years, too. It's part of what you do. More frequently. And part of that is putting us together in some kind of more collaborative centers for mission. And so I'm going to be a part of Anglican Global Relations and Diocesan Services and a larger group. And already I've been trying to infuse the various units with ecumenical thinking. And I think this new structure may allow that to happen even a bit more so that we don't think so specifically of our own little part of the world.
And how does that play out for diocesan synodical bishops?
About once a year, I worship at a Lutheran church, and during times when I'm not paying attention, I look at the index to see. I look at the copyright page to see how often Episcopal resources have been referenced, and it's really very encouraging.
We already have the ELW, so if you all want to join us, I think we're already halfway there, you see. But the other thing, though, you know, is that we're connected Episcopalian, we're connected Presbyterian, Reform, we're connected Moravian, we may very soon be connected Methodist. So when you're asking how do we become involved in the development of worship resources, it won't be just Episcopalian Lutheran, it'll be, you know, around more people than that. But as you look at the resources that are presently in our hymnal, I think in terms of our American traditions and American Christianity, you'll find a lot of it already that we do cross over each other and have for a long, long time, and our liturgies are certainly the same, and our hymnology is very much dependent upon Lutherans, but boy, are all strains of Christianity.
something that might sort of take us to our small roots a little bit. As you, as bishops, visit parishes and visitations, can you share anything about what different CCM is made as you see it, or more specifically, opportunities that CCM would address or could help with that have not been utilized? Things like, we can't have a youth group without enough kids, and why not go down the street and talk to Lutherans, that sort of stuff.
Well, as a bigger picture thing, for me, one of the things that I've been thinking of as I grow into my ministry as a bishop and look toward the time when I have that mantle, I am very interested in what CCM will be able to do to provide the underpinning for increasing synodical and diocesan conciliarity, interface with, you know, the ways that we all sort of make widgets in month-to-month church life, program, liturgical things, theological things, how we will do this to have Lutherans, folks from the Lutheran synods, in our church councils, in the broadest sense of the word, to me is a very interesting possibility. Consultations, less formal at first, certainly, and then growing in the formality of that, because if you're in full communion, the way in which you live your life from the bottom line into the way you witness in the world is going to have to be affected. It's going to have to come together. And I would love to see Lutherans from the Virginia Synods at our committee and commission tables, and in a more substantive way in our diocesan councils. We will all have canonical things and constitutional things we have to deal with. Those are going to evolve. I'm convinced they'll evolve. And so the interchangeability of orders is going to require, we take a look at how, we were talking about how to receive and transfer people, and I joked about Morehouse Barlow having to produce the right form of paper. But we all know that there are administrative realities there that have to come about. So conferring in that together, to me, is a very interesting way to do it. And when you have people from very different modes of doing these kinds of things, it's going to radically change the assumptions people bring to the table instead of committing the, and how long do I hope I'm out of here by 2, that kind of thing. It will change a lot of the mindset as we sit down, and that's very exciting.
There's a saying, and I don't know who it originates with, but the saying was that while it's hard to think our way into a new way of acting, it's easier to act our way into a new way of thinking. And in Virginia Beach, when Mark arrived in Virginia Beach, he and I had known one another when he was in South Bend. And when he arrived in Virginia Beach, we decided that we were going to share as much as we could share at that time. And when CCM finally was agreed upon, we've shared Eucharistic tables, we've shared Lenten programs and dinners back and forth between the congregation.
October 5th.
Boy, they still talk about that. There is a new judicial regulation in the city of Virginia Beach called Oktoberfest. We'll discuss that later. We merged our vacation Bible schools. We would rotate back and forth for lessons. Thanksgiving, we invited Emmanuel Lutheran Church to join, and we would rotate the site, the preacher, the celebrant. All this trying to build a relationship between people. And it's a start. And so we haven't brought it in. Next Tuesday. But we've worked hard at it, and the intentionality is there. Just share that as one offering for what's going on at the grassroots level, congregational ministry.
At a grassroots level, why couldn't you bishops? I'm retired out of here.
Can't touch your picture.
Send out a letter to whomever is in charge of clerici, and ministeriums on the local level and say, hey, why don't at least every other time Lutherans and Episcopalians meet together? very good friend of mine is the new rector at Christ in St. Louis. We play golf here. It's pretty bad, but we don't play for money yet. We will. And I was invited to his installation. Well, I know a lot of the Anglican Episcopal clergy in the area, but there were some I could see who said, "Who's that?" And one guy said, "Well, you know, if we were in clericus and ministeriums together, in our ministerium, I don't go to it so bad, I don't finish. I'm retired. And, you know, why couldn't you say, why don't you people do this?" That if the clergy got to know each other, like Stan and I got to know each other, you do things. If you don't know, you don't do things.
I just say, we have done that. We do that.
I knew you would. I could tell.
I'm standing all that.
That people who are most eager to do that are the people who have nothing to lose from it. People whose situations are already tense, or difficult, or neighborhoods are tough. The issue is more that still our prominent downtown churches that are located across the street from each other and do compete to see who has the best choir and the greatest art program. Those are places that are tough to sell on that kind of thing. But in the trenches, in the real trenches, people are more open to this. And I've been sitting here thinking about a little thing I did with the with Bishop Chain a couple of days before Christmas, which was a joint broadcast back and forth between us in our comfortable place at the bottom of the National Cathedral there, and the Lutherans and the Episcopalians of Bethlehem, the Anglican community and the Lutheran. There are places in the world where this is really a matter of life and death, you know, and places in Africa, too, where we really need each other, lest we die, you know, and we're blessed here in a way we sometimes overlook, to be able to talk about it a little more abstractly, you know. But other people could probably teach us more than we let them about why this matters.
Well, then, about 2.5 years ago, your predecessor, Bishop Schneider, and I facilitated a meeting in Northern Virginia of the ELCA deans with our deans who served in comparable areas. And that has already led to friendships and cooperation. And that's something that could be done again.
And some of those deanships were contiguous, you know, Lutheran to Episcopal, and that worked, and mine wasn't, so
right.
I was at the luncheon, but nothing ever connected because one little finger of my region is covered by you. By
that's
your.
Right.
Some of them, obviously, they were starting to ferment right there.
That's right.
I really appreciated Shannon's comments because Lutherans are to Episcopalians in Virginia what Episcopalians are to Lutherans in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so much stronger church to say, come sit with us is a different kind of peace. And so we give thanks for that. We have three dioceses to try to work with, and we have five presbyteries that we work with, and we also are now meeting with Richard Vogt with the Reform Law. And so as you start saying, who should you, how do we get our clergy together to meet, there are a lot of ways in which we're trying to stretch and to do that. And we do celebrate every time local congregations do, and we all over our state we do have that kind of peace, but it's hard to make that happen again and again.
I certainly want to thank all of you, our bishops, for sharing how you perceive this matter and what's happening.